Welcome to
One of the Family.
First off, I've got to say a million thank yous for the Dog Desk Award 2021 for the best animal-related podcast. Here it is. Maxwell tried to chew it, but I managed to save it. It's a brilliant feeling because this was voted for by people. And knowing that you like this is wonderful. Got a good episode. It's a good story, this one. Penfarthing, right, Penfarthing. The claims, the counterclaims, the truth, the lies about Operation Ark and the cats and dogs of Afghanistan. What really happened? And that amazing animal charity, Nowzad. Penfarthing is going to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Tell me about why you set up this incredible charity, when you set it up and why it was so needed.
I served as a Royal Marine Commando, I actually did 22 years. And during 2006, I went with 4-2 Commando to Helmand Province. And we went to the town of Nowzad, so just a small market town down near Kajaki Dam. And we were there, basically stopped Taliban fighters moving from our valley through to Kajaki. But whilst I was there, the Afghan police we had with us, they would organise dogfights in the evening as entertainment. So they'd just take two stray dogs off the streets, pit them against each other. The dogs are very territorial, so they'll fight. And whichever policeman, you know, brought the dog that won the fight, then he, you know, had the respect of the others, and probably some money as well, I would imagine. So I didn't like seeing that happen. So I broke up one of those dogfights. Our guns were bigger than theirs. And I didn't think too much of it. And then a couple of days later, I actually found, when I was doing my patrol around our compound, so I was the troop sergeant, I found one of those dogs that had been used in the dogfight actually hidden away in this like spare room that we had that no one used. He didn't like me. I didn't like him because he was very, very aggressive. I thought he was going to bite me or one of my guys. He obviously thought I was going to use him for dogfighting. And so I had to get him out, but I couldn't just go in there and pick him up because, you know, he'd rip my arm off. He was all battered and bruised. He had no ears. His ears had been docked. His tail was missing. Lots of scars down the side of his face. So I realized the only way to get him out was to actually coax him out some biscuits, some military biscuits. They taste like cardboard. They're absolutely disgusting, but he seemed to like them. And as I got him out, you know, tight over a couple of days, getting him to come out of this room and then trying to get him towards the gate, actually me and him fell for each other. And then he'd realised I was coming around with these biscuits and he'd actually come out to see me and his little stumpy tail was wagging away. And then he'd just sit down and I thought one day I'd risk it. So I started just trying to stroke his head. And he absolutely loved it. And I realised he loved me rubbing what was left of his ears. And so I couldn't bear to then kick him out. I named him Nowzad, just simply because he was war-torn, just like the city, the town that we were fighting over. And that's how it started, really. He was my 5 minutes of peace and quiet. You know, just I was like sitting with a magical carpet. He just whisked me away to being back home and not being in that chaos of Afghanistan.
You turn that little being, that dog's life around, and his entire trust in humanity was, thanks to you, transformed. What happened to Nowzad?
Nowzad, the dog, you know, I said I couldn't bear then to leave him behind. When our tour came to an end, I realised, you know, we were going to leave, and as all things with the Marines, you suddenly get a notice you're going to be gone. Yeah, that's you, and then you're replaced. They don't advertise the fact. So I realized I had to start trying to plan to get him out. I thought, you know, why not? Let's get him back to the UK and he can come and live with me. it always sounds so simple when you just say these things, but he ended up being smuggled across Afghanistan to Kabul, from Kabul then flown to Islamabad in Pakistan, and then from Pakistan flown to London. And back then we used to have full on 6 months quarantine. So he eventually came out of quarantine on the 24th of December 2007 to live with me. And that became then the catalyst for everything that followed. I thought I was unique. I thought, well, I was the only soldier who was looking after a dog on the front lines in Afghanistan. Turns out I wasn't. As soon as my story made the local paper, my mum had put it in the local paper back home in Essex, I suddenly started getting requests from other soldiers saying, hey, seeing you've looked after this dog and you've managed to get it out, how do I get my dog out? And so that's how the Nowzad charity started. And to date now, you know, moving forward, 2021, we'd actually helped over 1,700 soldiers be reunited with a dog or a cat that they'd adopted out in Afghanistan.
Amazing.
Yeah, and that's the legacy from that, you know, basically adopted fighting dog that, you know, nobody had wanted. And, you know, I first thought that was going to just be a, you know, an aggressive dog and I needed to kick him out, and he turned out to be a right softie.
Love changes everything, doesn't it? When he came out of quarantine and seeing you and going to your home, that must have been amazing for both of you.
I mean, yeah, I still remember it to this day because he wasn't house trained at all. You know, he'd never, ever been in a house before. So I'd actually, and he'd always lived outdoors. So I'd built him an outdoor kennel in my garden. And I lived down in Exmouth at the time, down here in Devon. And so I built him this lovely outdoor kennel, you know, outside, little hutch and all that kind of stuff. And I'd insulated it, spent a long time doing it. And then the first night he slept in the living room and he never left. So that kennel just stayed empty out in the back garden. But yeah, he, you know, having him home and, you know, was just amazing. And I realized then that the bond that we shared, you know, my tour, you know, same as all the subsequent tours, really, you know, they weren't positive at all. You know, we lost two of our guys, you know, two of my young Marines never come home, and five were seriously injured. And he just seemed to be the only little positive connection to Afghanistan. And I realized then when other soldiers were asking me to help them, they felt exactly the same way. You know, this dog or cat was something they could actually grasp, and it was positive about what they were doing, because, you know, we didn't see the bigger picture. And, you know, I can, you know, now I can talk about it with our, you know, our staff and the female staff that Nowzad as a charity employed. Back then, we actually, the security British troops brought to Afghanistan was the fact that girls' schools could open again.
I want to know what happened to Nowzad. A happy life. How many years did he spend with you?
Nowzad had 7 years in the UK. He turned into a right softy by the end, but sadly, as they all do, he just got too old too quick. His back legs stopped working, and, you know, I had to say goodbye to him. You know, it's just, you know, an absolutely horrendous day. That was back in 2014. We knew it's coming. You know, I knew that I was going to have to take him in, you know, within the week, and then it came the next day, or that, you know. And so I took him out to his favourite walk and basically carried him out of the car, put him down in the field. You're going to get me going now. And say goodbye to him. And then obviously drove from there straight to the vets. You know, and sadly they do what they have to do. But he's always thought I'd, you know, I'd spread his ashes somewhere special. But I didn't want to take him back to Afghanistan because I knew I wouldn't be there forever. So he's actually still downstairs in my living room. So I'm going to have to do something with him someday. But he's still downstairs actually at the minute.
Just an extraordinary story of how, you know, one person and one dog and the love and how everything does change. It's just, it's astonishing. The fact that they were taking dogs to dogfight, I mean, these are not human beings without empathy, without feelings, without sensitivity.
It's the same anyway you go, isn't it? America sadly has a big dogfighting ring, you know, and they class themselves as being an educated country. So it was just the fact that these people had absolutely no emotional attachment to an animal, and they just saw it as a means to, you know, some form of satisfaction with watching these two animals fight. You know, my view always has been, if, you know, if you want to make animals fight, well, then put some gloves on yourself and get in the ring. You know, why do you need to watch something else fight? It, you know, it's, yeah, it's just horrendous. And sadly, it goes on, you know, all over Afghanistan, you know, on a Friday after prayers. You know, that's when normally all the dog fights will happen. And sadly, in places like Kabul, there was just too much money involved. You know, a dog fight would have $50,000 riding on the outcome. It's absolute madness. And we, as a charity, said that we wouldn't take in any fighting dog, you know, they've been injured. We just try and, you know, stop them doing it. But clearly, you know, when they did bring us a dog that had been injured, we used to treat it because we couldn't just turn the dog away. And we had one dog, absolutely amazing dog called Apollo. Massive. He is huge, absolutely huge. And he came in, and the owner, because during the dog fights, I don't know if you're aware of this, but they actually crop the ears. And so, because then the dog doesn't have this big floppy thing to have it, you know, pulled by the other dog and obviously injure it. So this owner had just cropped his dog's ears, and when he brought the dog to us, the dog's ears were full of maggots because he'd let it become infected because he hadn't cleaned it, and he'd literally taken the ear down to the bone. And we all saw this big fighting dog, and normally they're quite aggressive, so we're all like, okay, right, Mustafa, you can go and treat this one. And then you'd be like, no, I think one of my vets could do with the practice, I'll send one of them. And we're all worried and scared about this big dog, thinking, you know, it's not going to be too happy. Oh, it turned out to be the softest thing ever. Absolutely loved people. And so we told the owner, we said, oh, I think it's really bad. I think the maggots have gone to its brain. So, you know, I think that we're going to have to put it to sleep. And so this owner, who was going to use it for dog fighting, was really depressed, but said, okay, because that's how much he cared about it. He left us, so we just cleaned the maggots out of the dog's ears, named him Apollo, and he lived with us. And he's one of those dogs that we've rescued that's come over to the UK. So
how can he trust people so readily, given what he's been through with some people?
But that's the power of dogs, isn't it? You know, they know, I think, who's a good person, and they know who's a bad person. Yeah, and you'll see a dog when you're that. We either come up to you and it's super friendly, or they just know to be wary. You know, and Apollo, yeah, he knew all of us, and all he loved was cuddles. I mean, I even had, you know, he was the biggest dog who probably felt the cold the least. Yet our staff knitted him a woolly jumper for the winter times in Kabul, because they were just so taken with him and he was so taken with them. So, yeah. But yeah, we'll always remember Apollo, that's for sure.
Where is he now?
So he's in quarantine at the moment, because with Operation Ark and bringing our animals over, my dogs that I looked after in Kabul, I've got three, Ragnar, Cora and Ewok. They were always coming to the UK when I, you know, finished. I was hoping that this Christmas, me and my wife would say, right, you know, we've done 2 years straight in Kabul. We'll come back to the UK for a bit now. So I'd already got my three through the DEFRA blood testing. You know, so they were fully vaccinated, as all our dogs were, but they'd actually been DEFRA blood tested. But dogs like Apollo, we never had a plan to get him adopted to the UK. So whilst he was vaccinated, he wasn't DEFRA approved. So when we suddenly had to evacuate Afghanistan, dogs like him and a few of our others had to go into quarantine. There's no way around that. You know, which that's the price that we had to pay for getting him out safely out of Afghanistan. So he'll be rehomed once he's finished that quarantine period.
It's incredible that these animals can be so brutalized, yet at the heart of it, all they want to do is have cuddles on the sofa.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
In Afghanistan itself, in Kabul, are there lots of dogs just wandering the streets and in other places, obviously?
Thousands of them, everywhere. There's been no animal control for, you know, whether, you know, humane or inhumane. There's been no animal control for like the last 40 years. you know, it's just absolutely nuts. You would just see literally dogs all the time.
What do we do?
Yeah, you know, it's got to be a long-term project. And now, sadly, with the Taliban back in power, it's not a priority whatsoever.
You know, what are the dogs living off? What are they eating?
One of the things in Kabul, I can never ever get my head around this, but there's no rubbish collection to note, really. And so all of the waste is just piled up in corners around on the streets. And people then who survive from recycling will come along and they'll take all the plastic out. Somebody else will come along and take all the tins out. Somebody else will take the paper out. And then all the waste food is also there. So the stray dogs always have a source of food. It's very, very rare in Kabul you'd see a skinny stray dog. So food was never their problem. It was disease. And we've just seen really in the last few months before we left in August that we'd seen an uptick in rabies cases. So there was more dogs that we were seeing that actually had confirmed rabies, which we were particularly concerned about. But obviously, again, now there's no one there to stop that. When the Taliban were in power, before we came in 2001, was they'd actually banned dog fighting because of
gambling.
One, it was gambling, and two, people were handling dogs, and so they didn't want that. So dogs were actually banned. Dog fighting was actually banned back then. So the only positive I can think about this whole sorry mess is they'll actually ban dog fighting again, which would be great news, but. Whether they will allow projects like Nowzads, to continue, we truly don't know. Because at the moment, no one really has any grasp in the Afghan government to actually how to run the country, let alone deal with, an animal welfare charity. So we're going to be well down on the list of priorities. The Taliban actually, our accommodation, our clinic is still in Kabul. And the Taliban actually came to visit it 2 days ago. To some of our staff who are still there, and they got arrested and interviewed by the Taliban, and they had pictures of me on their phone and wanted to know where I was.
You got so much criticism for people who clearly had some kind of an agenda. People I saw on Twitter that I follow, and I thought, you've fallen for all this shit. You've fallen for it. I've got to say, Dominic Dyer, what a hero. What an animal hero.
Absolute legend. I mean, he's the reason, we were so successful. I sat there in Kabul and you literally thought, at the start, I think probably about, I don't know, the 13th, 14th of August, that was it. I'd eventually have to leave Kabul and leave them all behind, leave my dogs behind, leave the staff behind. And then Dominic Dyer, I met him once at a Nowzad event a couple of years previously. Never really spoke to him. I stood, had a quick beer with him and a chat, but that was it. And he just came out of the blue, this motivational bolt of lightning that was like, right, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and he just ran away with the show, and it was absolutely amazing. And I think, as I found out, without a shadow of a doubt, every time I pick up a newspaper now, I am so wary of what I'm reading, because it was just one person's view, I think, which changed the whole narrative about Operation Ark. And suddenly it became, pets before people. And how that happened, I still don't know.
No.
It's opened my eyes big time to, how a story becomes something completely different and then it runs away. And that then becomes what everybody believes. It's just crazy. People have this one view of how things have happened and they won't listen to another view. I mean, even last night, I was sat up till about one doing, trying to catch up on emails because Operation Arc, my inbox, and I am not exaggerating this figure because I can show you a picture of my phone to back it up. I had 36,000 emails in my inbox. I've got a team of people who are going through them all so we can try and respond to everybody.
How many were from John Lewis? How many were from Vodafone? We're talking about this.
I wish they were, because I could just search for that and then delete them. But one email last night, and I read it, and it was like, Penfarthing, you're a coward. You absolutely disgust me. I cannot believe that you got your animals out and deserted your people. And this email was sent yesterday. And I'm like, have you not read the news? We got our staff out. They said they're safely now in the United Kingdom. They're going through resettlement. Our animals are out, because that was always the mission, was people and animals. And they replied saying, okay, but you still left before your staff. And I'm just like, you can't win. It doesn't matter what you tell people, you tell them the truth. If they want to believe something different, they will believe something different. And that's the way of the world, sadly.
Okay, here is the truth. Not the spin, but the facts. Not the black propaganda, but what actually happened at that airport.
We'd always said it was people and animals. And if you saw the pictures of the military aircraft, they are just one cargo space. So the people get on there. So if I'd have tried to get my animals on one of those military planes, yes, people would have been pushed, you know, they'd have had to make space for the animals. So we wouldn't have been able to take all those people. So that's why we came up with the idea of our own privately funded commercial aircraft, because it's got to have a cargo space and a passenger cabin. You could put animals in the passenger cabin, but you can't do it the other way around. You can't put people in the cargo hold. So if we filled that aircraft with people in the passenger cabin, the cargo hold would be empty. So why not fill it with animals? You know, it's a win-win then. And we only had 67 staff. Our aircraft was 230 seats. It was an Airbus. So I had 230 seats. So we could take basically, you know, another 130 odd people without any dramas. And we kept offering this to the British government. We kept saying, look, we've got these spare seats. You can fill them. You know, our cost is going to cost nothing to you. Just let us in that bloody airport. And even on the day we arrived, you know, people weren't, you know, the military was like, no, we don't need your aircraft. Yeah, I'm reading stories now that people who actually got to the Abbey Hotel were turned away because they said, we haven't got enough aircraft to put you on. And we took off. I took off after the British military with basically 229 seats spare. Just me, sat there on my own with all the animals. I've got the whole aircraft to me with five crew and me. Nuts. I still got that. When we arrived into Heathrow, it was just me on the flight with all the animals. So when we got to the first time we tried to get to the airport, when we finally got clearance off the British government to go, you know, they forward us the basically they call it the call forward paperwork. We had to go through three different Taliban checkpoints. So that took us near on 17 hours to do 5 miles, took us about 17 hours because we get stopped. The first time we got stopped, myself, I was in the middle of the front truck. I had Fareed, my office manager, was driving, and Mustafa, my senior vet, was next to me. And the Taliban came out, saw us, cocked their weapons and pointed them directly at us in the cab. So all three of us were just like this with our hands up in the air. And that's how we spent the next hour before they would agree to let us with our two trucks and the two buses, all our family members on, through to the airport. And then we get to the next checkpoint and then we go through the same process again. So by the time we finally managed to get into the perimeter of the airport, and again, this is where it drove me up the wall when I came back. My wife showed me the news reports. They said the British came out to help me. There was no British soldiers at all, because you've got the perimeter of the airport here, The actual road into the airport is about 600 meters long. And then you've got the terminal, and that's where the British were. So you still had to get all the way from the front gate, 600 meters along the main road into the airport to the terminal. And the British were stood across a piece of barbed wire at the terminal. The Taliban controlled the entranceway. And we got into the airport itself, but not to the British checkpoint. And the Taliban said, Joe Biden changed the rules. And I went, what do you mean to change the rules? They said, well, the only people who can come in now to the airport have got to have a valid passport. And all my staff, none of them had a valid passport. They all had these call forward letters, but no passport. And I said, well, they're not going to America. They're going to Britain. And the Taliban said, no, Joe Biden has told us we can only allow people in who've got a valid passport. And when I argued, they stuck a gun in my face and said, you either leave or face the consequences. So as we started turning round, that's then when the two suicide bombers at the Abbey Gate detonated. We were literally 500 metres away from that. So the confusion, the Taliban, you had all these people trying to run away from the suicide bombing, you know, a couple of thousand people trying to get away from that. The Taliban then started shooting at us, you know, shooting above our heads, trying to scare people off, start throwing tear gas bombs, and then beating people with sticks. So it just became absolute carnage. And we had to, you know, drive through this tear gas. Obviously, the dogs and cats are on top of the truck. We didn't realize how badly some of them were affected. You know, we were trying to drive. You know, Fareed was totally blinded by the tear gas. So we had to pull him out of the way. And then I took over driving to get our truck through. And then we had to go back and get the next truck because the guys behind were suffering from the tear gas. And then you've got the two buses with families on. You know, you've got little kids who are being tear gassed. It was absolutely horrific. And I watched the Taliban fighter stood next to our bus. There was two of our small kids were sat in a seat by the window. And he stood outside with his AK-47 on fully automatic, trying to scare us to move forward. But we can't because our driver's suffering from the effects of the tear gas that just dropped on us. So we couldn't get the staff through into the airport, but the Taliban had said I could. And so I'd refused to go that time. So I want to make sure the staff got back safely. And then I drove back the next day again with the two trucks just of animals for me to leave. And that's why I flew out on my own, because we then went into plan B for the staff, which was to smuggle them out of the country via land to the Pakistani border and then into Islamabad, or to Pakistan and Islamabad. It took 2 weeks to plan and prepare. You know, everybody thought I was in Norway in quarantine with my wife, not doing a lot. But you know, we were still in our war cabinet, as we used to call it. You know, of planning and getting it all ready for the staff and getting them ready. And then one night we just said, right, there's some buses going to turn up. You get on them, you go into the border, leave everything behind. And so they did, and we held them at the border for 5 days in a really crappy hotel on the border before we could get permission from the Pakistanis to open the border to allow ours to go through. And then once on the other side, we basically handed them over to the British High Commission for Pakistan. And the rest, as I say, is history. You know, they're now here in the UK going through their, you know, starting their resettlement process.
Amazing. And as for the animals and the dogs, they must have, many of them being incredibly traumatized by it.
Yeah, I mean, we actually had 75 cats. You know, sadly, we lost six of them due to the effects of the tear gas, the younger ones. What we think had happened is, you know, tear gas, it sticks to you. You know, it stings your face, obviously makes you want to gag. And if you've got clothes, you know, you have to wash them afterwards. But the cats, we believe, obviously it's stuck to their fur. So they're trying to lick themselves clean and then they're just ingesting this tear gas. So during the autopsy on them, we found that actually they all had severely inflamed throats, which had probably stopped them from breathing. You know, and there's nothing we were able to do because, you know, during that whole process, I had no facilities when I was stuck at the airport. waiting for our flight to come in to be able to get them out of crates. And I'm not a veterinarian, so I only have very limited, you know, basic knowledge. So yeah, sadly they didn't make it, and then we lost one cat. Once it arrived in the UK, it was still suffering from that tear gas. And when he was in on a veterinary table and being going through the process, ready for the operation to pop the tube down his throat, the breathing tube, he died under anaesthetic. So yeah, the rest survived, you know, and thankfully we've been to see them all. Yeah, they're all doing incredibly well. And my three dogs are here now with me down here in Exeter. You wouldn't even know what they've been through.
Wow. How many animals altogether did you get out?
94 dogs and 68 cats. So, and they're a mixture of dogs and cats. You know, either they were for people who worked out in Kabul, contractors. Some of the ladies at the British Embassy had cats. You know, so we suddenly got taxis just turning up in the days before the Taliban arrived, where all these expats were sending us their dogs and cats and saying, "We're getting evacuated. Please, can you look after them? And if you go, can you bring your dog and cat with us?"
So what about the politicians really casting a dim light on everything that you were doing?
I think people used me as a distraction for the complete and utter cock-up of that withdrawal. It was absolute madness. I mean, just 2 weeks earlier, the US had closed down Bagram Airport. It was the largest military base in that part of the world, and it could have easily handled this withdrawal from Afghanistan. They could have had a staging post in Kabul where you registered your intent to leave. They could have made a deal with the Taliban to allow safe passage to Bagram, and then that way you actually stop those chaotic scenes you saw at the airport. But no one thought that far ahead, and the way the system was run was just an absolute mess. Mm. That was the simple tagline, wasn't it? Pets before people. And it's just, yeah, you know.
Bollocks.
Yeah, bollocks. you know, it could have been prevented. It so could have been prevented what happened. And I still do not understand why America and Britain and all the countries, NATO countries, did not say to the Taliban, "Fine, we're going to leave. No problem with that. However, for us to leave, you go to the negotiating table and you actually guarantee things like women's rights, you know, women's education, that kind of stuff, you know, is on the table. You've got to agree to it, and then we will pull out." But to leave and just say, "Don't shoot us in the back, we're going." I mean, we've destroyed a country in 2 weeks. My wife, she worked for an NGO that dealt with young Afghan girls, 16 to 23 years old, basically, you know, inspiring them and giving them confidence to be leaders within their communities. You know, and these girls, I mean, absolutely amazing, amazing, you know, people to spend time with. They're now in refugee camps all around the world. They're probably going to be in these camps for like a year. And it's, you know, and they're just escaped with nothing. Just the clothes they were stood up in. My wife was trying to talk to some of them a couple of weeks ago. You know, they're every day they're in communication, they're trying to discuss where they can get them to, et cetera. And said, "Right, make some notes." And the girls can't even get a pencil to write on a notepad to make notes about what they've got to say to when the immigration people come around to figure out where they're going to go to. And no one seems to care. We've absolutely destroyed a country.
Do you think you did change minds and people seeing what you were doing and thought, "Hang on a minute, you know, maybe there's another way to think about animals"?
100%. People don't know what they don't know. So if you suddenly give them that experience, you give them that opportunity, they can then, you know, everybody's allowed to make their own mind up, aren't they? And so people would, you know, we used to do the Animal Hero Award. So if an Afghan brought us an injured dog or cat, we'd call them back in like a week later or so, and we'd present a little ceremony with a certificate for the Afghan Animal Hero Award, you know, for their outstanding support in not looking the other way, but taking the time to bring an animal to us, and we'd have tea and cakes, you know, and make a big thing of it. And people used to love that, because yeah, they're being recognised for, you know, doing something positive in their community. And we really, really did want to, you know, continue our work. And maybe one day, you know, our vets are going to be retrained, so they'll be obviously, you know, British qualified veterinarians. And then the rest, you know, we've said to them, right, what do you want to do? You know, because as a charity, we said, you know, we vowed we will support them all the way through, so they're not going to be a burden on the taxpayer. And that's what we're doing now. So English language is key. We've got them all working hard on English language skills, which is absolutely fabulous to see. When you see the kids all sat there learning English, that puts a right smile on your face.
Yeah, I bet. Never mind the criticism. You got a lot of love, didn't you? You got a whole lot of love as well on social media and elsewhere.
It was amazing. Nicky, I will never, ever forget that. The love, compassion people showed us was just, it blew me away. And I'm trying now, we're trying to thank everybody who emailed us. And I haven't even started on the social media messages yet. But, you know, we try to let everybody know it was just absolutely amazing. So much support. You know, and I think people realised it was the one positive thing, you know, that was coming out of that sorry, absolute catastrophe of a withdrawal. So, yeah, I'll never ever forget the support people gave us. That's why I'm sat here with, you know, my dogs and, you know, the staff are, you know, going through this resettlement process is because of people out there who showed their compassion.
Penn Farthing, thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me on. Absolute pleasure to talk to you.